Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fandy Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Rachel.
And today we have three very special guests in order of appearance on my screen. We have Beth Cato. Hello.
Hello.
Want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm the author of The Clockwork Dagger and The Clockwork Crown, which are steampunk fantasy novels. I was born and raised in California. I live in Arizona now.
What's Arizona like?
Hot.
Yeah, sounds about right. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Our second guest is Sherry Priest. Hello.
Hello.
And would you like to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Well, I write books and stuff. I had been doing it for quite some time, and nobody really cared until I wrote a steampunk book. And then suddenly, I had a career. Yay! let's see. I was born in Florida, grew up mostly on the Gulf Coast there and in Texas, and moved around a lot. Dad was in the Army. A lot of people think I'm a Seattle author because I lived there for 6 years and some of my stuff is set there. And a lot of people think I'm a Southern author because almost everything else I've ever written was set here. And I was born and have largely lived elsewhere, but I will gladly claim either one, so it's fine.
So you basically have a professional career of confusing people about your
place of
origin. I do.
I don't even mean to. And you add in a name that is spelled with like a lot of vowels, and I'm just, you know, one big bundle of perplexing. It's okay, though. I try and just run with it.
Excellent. And our third guest is Jamie Goh. Hello, Jamie.
Hello there.
And would you like to tell folks a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I never know where to start with these, but okay. I run a post-colonial steampunk blog. That's what I'm most famous on the internet for, I guess. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of California, Riverside, which is hot most of the year. And I was born and raised in Malaysia, which is also hot most of the year and only has two seasons, dry and raining, where I currently am. And I write short fiction mostly. I have also edited a couple of anthologies. And yeah, most of my short stories take place in a steampunk Penang. And so I'm kind of interested in like alternate histories of like various places that are not Victoriana, basically.
Perfect. So today's topic, if it's not clear from the guests, is steampunk. We're talking about the wonders of steampunk, and I wanted a kind of varied lot of guests who write very different kind of stuff, and or at least deal with very different aspects of steampunk. And since Jamie brought up one of the things that is in my wheelhouse, which is post-colonial literature, I kind of wanted to start with that element of it, which is the kind of steampunk that deals with the sort of complexities of that period of time. I know that steampunk has received some criticism in the last, at least decade or so about being a little, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Romanticizing a problematic past?
Yeah, let's go with that. That's a really good way of, romanticizing a past full of some really complicated and, in some cases, really brutal and horrific elements. And I wanted to start by asking each of you, about how you think that steampunk actually helps us to explore that period in a unique way. And obviously, all of you don't write in the same exact period, and you take different takes on it. So do kind of approach that question, you know, from your own personal perspective. And I'll go in the same direction that I started, and I'll just start with you, Beth.
Okay. Well, my Clockwork Dagger books don't take place on Earth. It's kind of a created fantasy land that's based, the geography is based on Washington State, and it's the era itself is based on World War I Europe. So it's that level of technology and also that level of devastation. And the background of the books has Kaskentia as a kingdom along the coastline that has been fighting a 50-year intermittent war against the Waste, which is this blighted wasteland on the other side of the mountains. And to me, it's, I feel like I have a responsibility as a writer to show how colonialism is a very dark thing, and that, yeah, there may be some scientific positives to it and some other good things that come out of it, but it's at, you know, someone else is suffering for it immensely. And I think it's very important to show that and to be balanced.
Excellent. So balance, that's an interesting way of approaching. Could you expand on that a little bit?
It's the nuancing. It's showing the complications around the politics and the characters and how they intersect. And my next series, Breath of Earth, that's going to be coming out next year, takes place in 1906. And that's very complicated with post-colonial themes, because it actually has Civil War ended early in America because the Union allied with Japan. Now they form the Unified Pacific, and they're basically battling for world domination. And as the book is going on, they are taking on China. So it's a completely different kind of World War One that's on the Pacific side, with a huge refugee situation with the Chinese and other peoples, because Britain has also escalated their conflicts throughout the world. And it's very messy and dark.
Interesting. I'm assuming some of you have read Michael Moorcock's Warlord of the Air. Am I the only one that's read that one?
I have not.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
No, I haven't. I have my Nomad of the Times Dreams, like, you know, sitting on my shelf, ready to read, and I just have not gotten around to reading it, and I'm sorry for that, because I really want to read it.
I do really recommend it, because this, Beth, when you were talking about, you know, the escalation of the British Empire and this kind of alternate version of reality that kind of arises from a different take on a sort of ocean-based conflict. The Warlord of the Air actually does something, not the same, but a very similar thing with its focus on a kind of utopian reconstruction of the British Empire. Conquered huge parts of the world, and everything is quote-unquote hunky-dory, and like they have medical technology and trains that take you everything, and it's everything so wonderful. Only not so much if you live anywhere that's not in the British Empire. Or you are a subject of the British Empire. and it's really very interesting, and the villain of the piece is I believe he's a half Chinese warlord, hence the title of the piece. Well, his character is really interesting as a contrast, because he's not what, of course, the British propaganda makes him out to be, but he's also not villain, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
It's really interesting, and I don't want to ruin it, because the ending of the first book is, like, my brain broke a little bit. So.
Well, that sounds great. I've written that down. I'm going to have to check that out.
So let's jump over to you, Sherry, on the original question, right? The way in which steampunk helps us kind of explore certain periods of history. And as I recall, your work doesn't take a perspective on the same region of time or place. I believe it takes place in the American West. Am I correct?
Sort of. At least the first book does. Okay. Anytime, I will have, I think, 20 books in print this year. And anytime anybody says I've read your book, they mean Bone Shaker. So it's okay. I did buy a house, so I'm not complaining. Basically, I ended up, God, this was probably back around 2006 or 7, kicking around on a message board somewhere where a bunch of British teenagers were complaining about American steampunks. And it was very, you know, well, those poor posers, because obviously it can't be real steampunk unless it's set in Victorian England. And I don't usually engage the trolls, you know, but I was curious and I was like, well, you know, how come? And I got answers like, well, you know, I mean, here in England, we had all of this expansion, you know, and a lot of exploration. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, so did we. You guys went south, we went west. Okay, got it. Well, and we had like all of this, you know, like we displaced all these people and there were all these conflicts and wars. And I'm like, check. Okay, keep going. And, well, we had this big industrial revolution, you know, and we'll check, you know, we had that here too. And, well, you know, we had all of this, like, industrially driven or economically driven social inequality. I'm like, we liberated a slave class of 6 to 9 million people with no social or legal protection. I mean, you know, check. Like, we have all of the elements here. There's no good reason we can't do this here. And I had moved to Seattle fairly recently at the time. My husband took a job with Amazon Corporate. And I felt like I knew the place well enough to maybe tell a story about it. And I realized that a lot of steampunk tends to kind of run toward high tea, you know, with pinky fingers out. But not very far back in my own family's background, you go back about three generations and you have illiterate hillbillies. And some very intelligent people who were just never educated and never really had the kinds of opportunities that they would have preferred, obviously. So I've always been more interested in the blue collar aspects and the economic aspects of kind of who's on the bottom, who telling the stories of the people who, you know, didn't quite make it into the history books. And so, I basically, turned Seattle into a wasteland that was devastated by an industrial accident and kind of set up the world through a very narrow viewpoint through this woman and her son. And that book at the time was the last I was under contract for. And I mean, seriously, the book before that, I probably could have sold more copies out of a trench coat in the park. I mean, my career was basically over and I knew it. And I thought maybe this was the last thing I was going to ever publish under my own name. So, excuse me. This was just kind of a Hail Mary pass, basically. And when it took off and people wanted to see a sequel, I had no idea what to do because I kind of based my version of the steampunk world on the idea that the American Civil War just didn't end. I have spent most of my life in the Southeast, where alternate theories of the Civil War are kind of, you know, like a regional pastime, really. I mean, it wasn't that hard to kind of come up with, well, if this and if this and if this, maybe the South could have held on for another little while. And I tend to have a very unpopular opinion that the South lost the war as soon as they declared it because it was just a terrible idea. But I just needed it to drag out for a generation. And like just the way that technology is driven by war and the way that technology is not just war machines, but it's medicine, it's communication, it's all kinds of things like that. So when it came time to do a sequel, my real problem was, I mean, Pacific Northwest, not a lot of Civil War action. I didn't have to account for very much. I just kind of vaguely threw out a few things and let that kind of be in the background. So for the rest of those books, I took them back east and moved east to west with them, largely, to kind of show what the rest of the country looks like, where the West is unincorporated. And the Comanche got their own nation, which is what Texas originally wanted to give them in real life. And, you know, it's just like, and all of these, like, California isn't a state, and Washington and Oregon aren't states. They're, you know, loosely incorporated territories. And I don't know, it just like, once I kind of went down that rabbit hole, it was, you know, hard to dig myself back out.
You also went back down south, didn't you, Sherry?
Yeah, well, for Dreadnought, which is a sequel to Boneshaker, the number one piece of criticism described as or disguised as commentary was that you couldn't see what the rest of the United States looked like. And my family, a few generations back and at that time, was either in North Florida or in Appalachia. And the Appalachian end of the family, you know, there are stories about how they sent, you know, four sons to the south and six to the north and got three back from one and two from the other. You know, it was really in the border states, it was really very, very complicated because you had these areas where like the pro-Union or the pro-Confederacy, it was like 49% to 51%. And one way or another, it was very, very complicated. So I took a Southern woman who was married to a boy from Kentucky, which was technically a Northern state. And she gets an emergency call from back west, and she decides to, you know, take the trip west. And her husband is dead, and so she uses his military pension and all of that. So kind of playing with the class aspects of that and the political aspects of that, of someone who's kind of fighting something but depends on that secret. And people always want to talk about, like I did Clementine actually before Dreadnought, but that was a one-off through Subterranean. And you can't talk about the 19th century South without talking about slavery. I mean, like, you just can't pretend that didn't happen. You can't pretend we don't have black people here. We have a lot of black people here. And we did then and we do now. And the high tea version of steampunk that I had seen in the South, what little I had been very, you know, Gone with the Wind, On the Plantation, all the white girls in pretty dresses. And I'm like, that's kind of silly. There weren't actually very many people like that. There weren't very many people in that circumstance. And let's talk about everybody else. So I kind of got to play with the political climate and the social climate of that. And I'm sure I did not do it perfectly, but I mean, I did take a crack at it. And really all you can do when you screw it up is just listen to people who know better than you and try to do better next time, you know? So that's the philosophy I try to take with it.
Excellent, excellent. So why don't we bounce off to you, Jamie, because as you noted, right, you run a blog where you actually focus on post-colonial steampunk. And how do you kind of approach this question about the way in which steampunk approaches the problematic periods of history in which they are often set?
So firstly, I'd like to bounce off Sherry's take on steampunk, and especially Sherry, you talk a lot about the working class aspect, like looking at the working class aspect of society at the time. And one thing I really appreciated about your books, especially like Started From Dreadnought On, was how that intersection of the working class also deals with issues of race, and how race and class come together, and how education plays a role. I really liked Fiddlehead, for example.
Oh, well, thank you.
Different kinds of racialized people who also occupy different class statuses. And, yeah, and the other thing that you said about role-playing at the time, especially back in 2010 and 2011, and this is why Aileen the Peacemaker and I like got together and like, we gotta do something, like, this is ridiculous, like, everyone's so poncy and yeah, snobby and white, we gotta fix this. And I think I want to say that the landscape has changed over the past few years since then. And that's a thing that I've not been able to really like get a sense of. And the way that, I mean, part of my research right now is how steampunk is marketed, how it's been taken up commercially, and it's still this incredibly Eurocentric perspective, because that's the easiest way to sell it. It's the thing that's most familiar. So basically what I do is I look at technologies of the past that are lesser known, especially by like Asian countries, West and East Asia, and apply that to Southeast Asia, because Southeast Asia kind of like becomes this spot, this entrepot for Arab, Indian, and Chinese traders. And I'm kind of like slightly less interested in how colonialism plays out than I am in how the world, the geopolitics of a world comes about if you remove that intense capitalist-driven colonialism that the British instated during the 18th and 19th centuries. So my short stories are set in a steampunk Penang, which is where my parents are from. It was colonized. Well, it was, the island was leased from the Sultan of Kedah in 1786 by Captain Francis Light. And I was like, well, you know, that's kind of like one of the first footholds of British colonialism in the Malayan states at the time. So I'm like, well, what happens if that doesn't happen? What happens if you just kind of like maintain the fact that places like Penang, like Singapore, like Malacca, they're all entrepots. They're all places where you find a lot of traders from all over Asia, and especially the sea routes. And Malacca was one of the spots where Captain John Hurst stopped at. What happens if you don't throw in that capitalist, colonialist aspect of history? So I went in and I looked at like Arab technologies, which could have been brought over by Muslims for traders. I looked at like the Chinese isolationist policies, which affected their technological development. And I'm like, okay, what happens if you open it up? and what happens to the development of Southeast Asian technology, because we had a lot of weaponry at that time. We had very, very great swords being produced out of this region in Indonesia, in Malaya, that was basically pushed out of the market by Dutch and Portuguese traders who plied the sultans for better trade statuses. And they basically gave the sultans, like, you know, exclusive rights and monopoly trade, so that the sultans could get richer. And the sultans were like, okay, cool. And that kind of like pushed everyone else, the locals, out of the market. And within a couple of generations, you could like tell the young locals coming up, like, well, your people doesn't produce anything important, so why, you know, like, you're not that important. And it's from there that you can create whole generations who believe that, you know, they're naturally lazy. And this is kind of like covered in The Myth of the Lazy Native by Saitus and Alatas. He kind of predates Edward Said's Orientalism. In fact, I think it's an inspiration for Edward Said's Orientalism. So that's kind of like how I approach steampunk. Like, you can't keep looking at British colonialism and reconstructions of colonialism. That's really useful. People need to do that. But I'm also interested in, like, how do we change our image of the present by changing the image of the past? And how does that influence what we could think, how we could think about the future and what we want for the future?
Excellent. So, Sherry, I saw you had a hand to something that Jamie had said a little bit back. You want to jump in here?
Oh, just kind of halfway. What you were talking about earlier with the marketing of steampunk, sometime we should privately chat about the cover of Fiddlehead.
didn't we talk about the cover of, was it Ganymede?
Changed. The only thing they changed was the skin color of the woman on the cover, which infuriated me.
Oh, my God.
Well, no, I mean, it was actually the opposite of whitewashing. They made her darker. And the point was specifically, this is New Orleans in the 19th century. She needed to pass for white in order to own property. And she was a Union spy.
And then in the UK version, which I got, is like this
looks awesome.
Really, 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 really white lady with like straight nose and like high cheekbones. Yeah. Like, who is this? Like,
no, kind of the theme of the book is ambiguity. And I'm like, and the original cover, I had talked with the artist and he was great. And also this woman is in her mid-40s. And they changed nothing on the cover except for her, and they made her from an ambiguous woman in her mid-40s to a 20-something biracial girl. And I'm like, listen, I did 3 books with a 20-something biracial girl set in the South, and nobody put her on the cover. What is she doing on the cover of this book? This is insane. But for Fiddlehead specifically, and all I will say publicly is this, there are 3 main characters in that book. One is a mid-30s black man. One is a historical figure who was a woman. She was in her late 30s. And one is Ulysses S. Grant, who's in his 60s. I don't know who the 16-year-old blonde girl is on the cover of that book.
Oh, no.
I have no idea. And when I suggested that it seemed to kind of be appealing to a lowest common denominator, marketing went big old thumbs up on it. And I'm like, that's not what I meant. So, yeah, one of these days we'll have to sit around in a bar and bitch about that. But anyway.
Well, I do find it interesting. I was not aware of the part you had mentioned about having a character who needs to pass and the problem of representing that on the cover.
And it was great. I mean, I talked to the artist, and we went back and forth, and I gave him some source images of people who had kind of loosely inspired her, some people I had known. And I'm like, picture this woman, but like 20 years older, you know, that kind of thing. And I was not very happy with how that came out, because he did a beautiful job, and they sent it back and said no. And that was very frustrating to me. And it wasn't even that they changed her skin tone so much as they made her so much younger. And I'm like, come on, you know, like ladies of, I'm like, I turned 40 last week. I would like to see women of my age and better on, you know, on covers of things. And this woman, yeah. And this woman was very clearly maybe in her early 20s. And I'm like, no. And where were you when I was trying to get this woman on the cover of these other 3 books? And it was a very frustrating thing for me, but you know, yeah. And then the UK version, I appreciated what they were trying to do, and they did talk to me about it. And I was like, you know, we seem to kind of have some, I think maybe a disconnect with regards to the idea of ethnic ambiguity. It's something that people are a little antsy about touching. And I understand it's a sensitive subject, but it's also one that should be talked about. So yeah, it was just kind of, I don't even remember how it came about, but we were talking about, like, yes, well, this is generally what she looks like. And what they came up with was a woman who was lighter skinned than the person I had imagined. But I mean, ethnic ambiguity, which is a term I borrowed from a friend of mine who is ethnically ambiguous. And it's very, very hard to take something out of somebody's head and put it in an artistic depiction. And I think that they did the best they could. At least she looked a little older, I guess. It's like, well, I don't know. It's such a hard thing to put your finger on, and I try and respect that. But at the same time, there have been times when I kind of just wanted to start yelling about things. So I'll just stop right there.
Fair enough. Beth, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, the subject of covers. I mean, covers are scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, they sell the book, and I mean, I know as a kid I was drawing my own book covers and all this, so there's this whole dream behind what my book cover is going to look like someday. And I've been pretty lucky so far, knock on wood. Mm. My two covers are pretty good. My first cover, The Clockwork Dagger, I have my two main characters are on there. They're not exactly as I imagined. The clothing is very different because in my head, I think more World War One styled gear, and they definitely need to emphasize more of the steampunk for selling. But I mean, my editor for that book was fantastic. I mean, she was emailing me asking about Alonzo, my black male lead, and asking what tint of skin, how dark. I mean, so, and that really actually surprised me, because I mean, I heard so much about whitewashing and all that, and I was actually ready to fight. I was like, I'm going to have Alonzo on the cover, and he's going to look right. He's going to represent. So it was like, wow, he's not exactly how I imagined, but hey, I'll take with this. This is good. So, I mean, you never know. In my next book, Breath of Earth, my main character is a dark-skinned young woman. So I'm very curious to see what they do with that.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, yeah. Whitewashing is a topic that we may have to can of worms a little bit, because that
yes.
is a huge, huge, complicated topic, and is one we've never done on this podcast and probably should at some point. Jamie, you had a hand, and then Sherry, you had a hand after Jamie, so we'll go to Jamie first.
Okay. Well, please.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to Sherry's point about how young that character in Ganymede looks on the cover, because not only do you have this whole, she's got to look sexy, but that already implies this kind of ageism in so much steampunk marketing. Like, if you just Google steampunk, it's all these like really pretty young women in corsets, right, wandering around, and you're just like, so where are all the older women? Because I know they're there. I've seen them. I've seen whole families participate. Like, the way I got into steampunk, like, really dug into steampunk, was through like older folks who were willing to like share their knowledge with me, and they're just not represented visually in any steampunk marketing. And I find that such a problem, because it's really like, it's this huge erasure of kind of like generational knowledge in favor of selling this very particular ideal that doesn't actually make steampunk actually all that, you know, cutting edge or interesting, really. And I mean, that also plays up the racial aspects too. I remember I interviewed Nivy Hicks. So I did this series of interviews with people of color who do steampunk. And one of them is Nivy Hicks. She's based in Salt Lake City, Utah. She's the, I think she's the chair of Salt City Steamfest still. And she told me of this photo shoot where, you know, she came in her Indian steampunk outfit. They were at a group photo shoot, and they were ignored in favor of all these young women who were white, who are much more conventionally attractive, who did all these very, very basic poses in, I don't know, corsets and overskirts, I guess. And yeah, and it was just, she was kind of taken aback by that, because she kind of felt like, okay, this is not what I expect from a steampunk event. And to be fair, that's not what I expect from a steampunk event either. I just don't want to, like, I think there's a place for promenading yourself, but there's also a space for, like, actual diversity in what you're doing.
So, Sherry, I know you wanted to jump in here, too.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I'll just be real quick. Kind of as a little bit of an antidote to that, when Clementine came out, we had one cover artist lined up, and it kind of fell through. It doesn't bear a dry retelling, and no harm, no foul. But we ended up at the very last minute with no cover. So, and this was through Subterranean Press, which is a smaller, it's an independent press, and sometimes they're a little more nimble, shall we say. So Bill, the publisher over there, was like, well, tell me what you want to see on the cover. And I was really frustrated at this point. I mean, it's these two characters, and one of them is the same historical figure that the woman who's in her late 30s, and the other is this black guy who is much more central to the universe, at least in the first few books. And I was like, so I just sent this email to him. I'm like, you know what I want to see on a cover? I want to see a big freaking black guy. And I want him to be like older. Like, this is an adult man. This is a man pushing 50. And I want him to have a big freaking gun. And I want him to have a big freaking ship. And I want fire. I want lots of fire. Like, I just want him to be the biggest badass in the world. Unbeknownst to me, Bill forwarded that email to the artist. And I got exactly that. It is the coolest cover. I was like, and he's like standing on this pile of debris with like the ship on fire.
It is a really cool cover.
It is a great cover.
I was like, yes, this is amazing. Ask and you shall receive.
Yeah, I love that cover.
I was so tickled. Oh, but second, and just real quick anecdote, what you were talking about older ladies. The very first Steam Con, I was at that, and Boneshaker had only been out like 3 weeks and nobody knew who I was. But the fire marshal shut the place down. Specifically, he wouldn't allow any more people into the hotel because they'd hit their cap. You know what it is. But there were already people staying in the hotel who weren't part of the convention. So I'm downstairs in the lobby talking to some people, and this little old lady comes down, and she's wide-eyed, and this woman's got to be 80, okay? And she's like, well, what's going on here? And so a handful of people are like, oh, well, this is what we're doing. Would you like to see? And so they walk around, and they show her some costumes, and I swear to God, this woman looks at this friend of mine and goes, well, this is so much fun. I should go get mother. She goes upstairs and brings home, I want to say her mother was 101, something like that. Literally, this 100-year-old lady comes downstairs with her daughter, and like people ran them through the dealer's room and just dressed them up and turned them loose. And I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. I'm so tickled to be here. Yeah. But anyway, that was what I raised the hand for, and now on to other people, because like I said, I am into my second rum and ginger ale right now, so I'm just going to stop.
Okay. Well, Rachel, you had a hand. You want to jump in case you had a question or an area you wanted to steer us to?
I mean, for a minute, I just wanted to actually join in the cover woes, because I had like a novella series where the main character is a late 30s Latina who dresses in men's clothes, and try getting that on a cover. Mm. It's like, what do you mean there can't be cleavage? I'm like, she doesn't do the cleavage thing. She dresses in Duke. Okay. But what I kind of thought this could lead into is the question that I've heard get brought up at a lot of like steampunk panels, which is, are we getting like a little too much of the steam is in the aesthetic and not enough of the punk? Because that seems to be what keeps getting pushed aside with that, you know, just even having these protagonists that challenge story assumptions and cultural assumptions, and they keep kind of getting pushed aside even on the cover art. I'd kind of like to hear your guys' take on the do we need more punk?
Well, I mean, it depends on your definition of punk, really. I mean, there has to be some kind of transgression when you bring up the term punk. What kind of transgression are you talking about? Is it social transgression? Is it gender transgression? Is it, I mean, take your pick. And that's kind of how I always wanted to keep the punk in my stuff. I wanted to have as many transgressive characters as I could, or in their behavior or in their identity or whatever. The example I tend to hop back to is that nobody seemed to notice, like to this day, unless I pointed out, nobody notices that my steampunk Texas Ranger has a Jewish name. Like it just apparently has never occurred to anyone that there might be Jews in Texas in the 19th century, you know, but the idea that, and Texas is the example I tend to go back to, because I spent a lot of time there when I was a kid down in the Southeast Quadrant there. Beaumont Orange and Port Arthur. I lived in Orange. And they used to make you take Texas history. And I use this anecdote a lot, but it's quick. Don't worry. So I read the Texas history book for the older kids because it was a multi-grade private religious classrooms. And I went to my teacher, who I would like to be clear was not a Texan. He was a mean old man from New England, and I think he's dead now, and that's probably for the best. But I went up to him, and I was like, Mr. Hunt, I have a question. This was a really cool book, but how come there were no ladies in Texas? And
that's amazing.
Well, like I'm like 8 years old. I don't know. I read this book about Texas history, and there's no women in it. I guess there's no women in Texas, you know. So I was like, you know, what's going on here? And this guy looks at me and he's like, oh, sweetheart, there were ladies in Texas. They just weren't doing anything very interesting or important.
Oh.
And I was like in like third or fourth grade. And I'm like, what the hell? and so kind of the
no.
idea. I was a young girl living in Texas. Well, if I grew up to be a lady in Texas, could I not do anything important either? What kind of bullshit is this? But that kind of putting women front and center and people of color front and center. And I always try and have and try and like look at what the actual population looks like, which sounds like a strange thing to say. But Mary Robinette has a tweet that gets sent around a lot because it's brilliant about how it's not about adding diversity for the sake of political correctness. It's about subtracting homogeneity.
Yes.
You know what I mean? For the sake of reality. Like, it would be really stupid to write a book set in the 19th century in the South and not have any black people in it. Just like in the Northwest, it would be really stupid to write a book set in the 19th century and not have any Asian people in it. I mean, like, it's like trying to, and it is sad that that is transgressive, but it is.
But that's so easy to do. It's
so
stupid, and it's so easy, and that's why people do it, because how long do you want to, like, research your novel for?
Yeah.
You got to, like, push it out as soon as possible.
Wow. Well, but just living in a place. But just living in a place and looking around, like, I spent most of my time in the American South, and, like, I know what my neighborhood looks like. I know what my friends and neighbors and the people in my city look like. And it was very different for me going to the Northwest, where there are very few black people but a lot of Asian people. And, well, that looks different. And so, well, you start to look at this. Well, you know, what have you guys done, and what's important here, and what's – I don't know. It kind of – it's infuriating that it was perceived as transgressive and punk, that I just kind of put a lot of different – kinds of people into the stories, but because a bunch of different kinds of people were there, and nobody, no matter who you are or what you are, whatever your affiliation or your identification socially, gender-wise, sexually, religiously, none of us are 21st century creations. We have all always been here, and it's worth talking about. And steampunk, I think the punk in that is where it says it's also worth playing with, and I think that is the brilliant and goodness of it.
So Beth, you had a hand to something that Sherry was saying. You want to jump in here?
Yes, I agree completely, because to me, I look around like it's a colorful world, and books should reflect that historically. It's not. I'm waiting for someone to accuse me of having an agenda or things like that in my books, because I have a lot of black-skinned people in the Clockwork Dagger books. There's an entire nation, a city-state that is the dominant skin color. And to me, I'm waiting for people to go, well, you know, why is that? What are you trying to do? You know, the huffy people. I'm like, why not? Because I hate that idea that white is the default. And I think that that's way too often the assumption. I know that's how, when I was really getting into fantasy in my teens in the 90s, a lot of books were that way. And it took me a while to realize how bizarre that was, and I didn't question it for a long time, and I should have. And now I like to think I'm not as ignorant. I know I'm always learning, but I do want to look around with my eyes wide open and see the colors around me, see the different sexualities, see, you know, just everything out there that is part of the world, and it's not abnormal. It's there. It's everywhere. You just have to look for it. And I think that goes towards the question of the punk and steampunk too, because it's about bringing out that attitude and about having something to fight for. I mean, my characters, they have very firm beliefs and they have causes, and it's things that I would go as far to say it's like a faith to them, especially for Octavia in Clockwork Dagger, where she firmly believes that she can save people and prevent them from feeling pain through her magic from the lady, And by golly, you know, come hell or high water, she's going to help people. That's her calling. And that's where her punk attitude really comes in, because her compassion is her passion for life.
So something you had said a little bit earlier reminded me of, and I'm sure people have heard this old canard at this point, the idea that, that the African continent didn't get progress until the empire showed up, essentially. Because what you were saying was reminding me very much about that idea that you hear so much, shock and kind of disbelief at the idea of, say, for example, as you were mentioning about this idea of a predominantly black city state, an advanced culture of sorts, because we hear this time and time again, right, that the Africa we often hear about is not the Africa pre-contact, not the Africa, you know, that isn't influenced by contact, or even just the Africa now. Like, I mean, I think we've had Lauren Bucus on a couple of times, and she's mentioned, I think, in every single episode, how cell phones have, like, revolutionized how people engage with technology in South Africa. I mean, it's like, they use cell phones in a way different than how we typically use cell phones, because cell phones are essentially, like, the based on how I recall it, almost like their replacement computer, because a lot of them can't afford, like, actual desktop computers and fancy laptops, so they use their cell phones as their mass communication device, whereas we have, you know, tablets and cell phones and all these kinds of things. I think it's a really interesting thing that keeps coming up that proves to be false if you just do a little digging. Well, and I say little digging as in, like, you know, maybe just read one newspaper from Kenya, you know? Yeah.
One of my first culture shocks upon moving to Canada was how really shitty phone technology is in North America. It's like, what do you mean, like, you don't have, you're not on the GSM network? What do you mean that if I sign with you, I won't be able to, like, just change my phone anytime I like? Like, there's such a huge variety of different phones to use that would work for us and work for individuals. Like, what do you mean I can't just buy them? No. And I had to, like, sign with, like, AT&T Rogers, which is, like, one of the worst phone services in the world.
Preach it.
And I'm still with them, but that's because I'm, like, out of options. But yeah, I would have to buy phones from Malaysia, bring them back, just so I could have, like, a phone that I actually liked. And I was always very shocked to see the kind of, like, the limitations of the phone market. And now it's that kind of limitations has kind of, like, been brought over to Asia, where everything is a touchscreen phone now. And I hate touchscreens. Hate them. There might be a line about me bitching about that in Vintage Tomorrows.
Well, no, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, like, okay, I came back to Tennessee from Seattle, and everybody's like, ew, Tennessee. It's like, shut up. Have you ever been there? It's lovely. And I just bought a restored Victorian for the down payment on a shitty condo here, so I don't want to hear it. But, like, one of the great things about one of the great things about Chattanooga in particular is that we have, like, some of the earliest, like, fiber broadband internet that's treated as a utility. I get a full gig up and down for less than and 500 channels of cable, because it's all administered through the electric power board, for about 2/3 of what we were paying for crappy internet alone in Seattle.
Wow.
Right. And it's like, really? Like, in Appalachia? Shut up. This is the Deep South. Do you know nothing? Appalachia starts over there. This is not coal country. You have to go farther west and north. Sorry. But people have these preconceptions about, like, what you can. Literally, once when I was in Seattle, somebody went, Tennessee, ew. Do you guys have, like, cable there?
Oh, God. Come on.
And I was like, oh, and indoor plumbing and everything. Yeah. And so, and then, like, I was defensive at first for a while. And I was like, well, I was born in Florida. And I had this guy look at me and go, oh, Florida. Well, you know, they do have roller coasters there. And I was like,
wow.
Why is this a standard of anything? Why am I trying to impress people? Like, I don't even care. So after that, I just told everybody I was from Tennessee and they could suck it. But it's always, like I said, you know, I have a family from back in the day. It was from Appalachia in Kentucky, in coal country. And it's very, the preconceptions people bring to that are just staggering. I'm just agreeing with Jamie is all I'm doing. And then like, you go back somewhere, like when we got to Seattle and found out how crappy the internet was, we were like, are you kidding me? This is like Amazon and Microsoft, and we have to pay what for 3 bars? Oh my god.
It's a major city. What the hell is this nonsense?
Come yeah. on, guys. Get your act together.
Get your act together.
At least y'all have hot water.
Right. We do. We have indoor plumbing and everything. It's amazing. They won't believe it.
So, Jamie, you had a hand. You wanted to talk about punkiness. It's just something mm-hmm. that's come up a couple of times.
Yeah.
And wanted you to jump in here.
Okay, so just responding to the book cover conversation about what should go on the cover and what's marketable, right? When we're writing, we don't really think too much about market forces. We want to tell that story. And I think that's where the punkiness of steampunk is strongest, is in the literature, in the actual text, right? And in some of the role-playing as well, like the HMS Badger in Madison, Wisconsin, blah, blah. But the thing is, like, these are not particularly commercially viable. You can't just sell, like, a big block of text to people and say, yeah, this is steampunk. Like, no one's going to look at it, and it's not going to be recognizable. People recognize steampunk through the aesthetic, the visual aesthetic, right? And I think that's why we're so heavy on the steam, because punk, on the other hand, calls for defamiliarization of what we see. Right, so we are already subverting and changing something that's already familiar with the steam, and the punk does it even more, right? In on a level that most people are probably not willing to follow us to, right? We don't all follow the white rabbit down the rabbit hole, because rabbits poop all over the place, I guess. I don't know. And this kind of like leads to kind of like this idea that, oh, well, this is how it's always been. And so we get all these defaults of, like, you know, the kind of like homogenization to occur and kind of entrench itself. To respond to the thing about Africa and modernization and progress. So our idea of progress tends to be tied to modernity, mm-hmm. right? And our ideas of modernity are tied to particular I'm just going to say modes of thought, because that sounds suitably academic, and also because I haven't thought of a different way to put it, which kind of comes out of the Enlightenment era, which created, you know, it gave us our current systems of race, right? Like the Negro, their heads are shaped like this and they're not so smart, whereas the Caucasian or the white man, his shaped like that, so clearly it's like it's got a bigger brain, something like that, right? And so a lot of our ideas of what is modern come from the Enlightenment era, come from this one subset of thinkers in Europe whose thought went on to kind of like justify colonialism. And that's kind of like why we get entrenched in thinking, oh, Africa didn't have civilization. Oh, Southeast Asia didn't have civilization. We did. It's just not a civilization recognizable to how we're taught these days what civilization is supposed to look like.
Yeah, and unfortunately those kinds of images are constantly reinforced. I mean, honestly, the amount of information people in America probably know about Africa can be summed up by one of those commercials we see on TV. Because honestly, people don't know. I mean, they may be a little bit from the news, but if you'd ask them, like, I mean, for heaven's sake, you still hear people say, you know, Africa the country.
Yes.
As though that is actually applicable. It's a weird thing how that kind of stuff gets reinforced over time, even not intentionally, just based on what information we have access to, or what information we choose to have access to, at least. And then obviously some of that is, as Jamie was noting, right, historically is obviously intentional, certain ideas being peddled. So, yeah. Yay history, right?
But I mean, yay history, because history, like, when we look at history, it yields up so many interesting things that actually existed.
This is true.
I think, Sherry, you were going to say something about that.
Hmm? No, I was going to say, the thing that always cracks me up the most is when people, the emails I get where people are like, people weren't like that back then. This is obviously some, like, feminist agenda or whatever. Like, the character Maria Boyd was actually a fairly well-known historical character in the South. She was a Confederate spy. But in, like, I toned her biography down to make it more palatable to a modern audience because I thought nobody's ever going to believe me if I include all the stuff this woman actually did. Like when she was 16, roughly 16, we're not entirely sure when she was born, the Yankees came through and they stayed at her mama's house and a Yankee indecently assaulted her mother. So she shot him to death. And the union officers there at the time, I mean, they didn't have prisons for teenage girls or anything. And they were kind of like, well, he did have it coming. So what they did was they slapped her on the wrist and they said, now don't do that again. And what this writ... what this rich white girl took away from that was they can't touch me. And she ran with it. And she was friends with Stonewall Jackson and all these other people. So by the time the war was over, she had been married or left at the altar. She'd been in two prisoner of war camps. She had been, I believe, married and abandoned. That's a little iffy. But definitely married and widowed to a Union Navy boy. Had fled to Europe and come back to the United States, where it turned out she was too famous to spy anymore, and she was probably about 19. And I'm like, who the hell's going to believe this? But then I thought, how interesting to like portray this woman, like what happens to her in her 40s? What happens to her 20 years from now? Because at the end of the war, her family was broke, and they were out of money, and you know, she nearly starved to death, wrote her memoirs, and did speaking engagements. But people are all the time like, well, you just kind of made her extra badass because kick-ass ladies are the thing right now. No, she was an actual kick-ass lady. And or my other favorite is there's a character in Ganymede who's based on a historical figure. If you ever take the underground tour in Seattle, at the very end of it, there's this large photo on the wall. I want to say the date on it is about 1900. And it's Madame Damnable, is what they all called her, in the parlor with some of her ladies. And depending on your tour guide, they'll lean in and go, hey, here's a question for you. How many ladies are in this photo? Because one of Madame Damnable's girls was at least assigned at birth the male gender. And this had to have been an open secret. This was a working brothel. There was obviously a call for this person's services. Now, was this person, you know, a cross-dresser? Or was this person transgender in a time before you could really, change over like that? And we're not going to know. We're never going to know. We don't even know this person's name. But I chose to treat her as a transgender woman and set her in New Orleans. And I get more email about that. Well, people didn't do things like that back then.
Oh, geez.
Oh, yeah.
That's such a fascinating argument.
I know. Like, because, really?
Like, I mean, part of it is that the whole, oh, genders are such rigid, we have such rigid gender rules. Like, that's really a product of the Victorian era, of the 19th uh-huh. century. Before that, it was actually a lot more acceptable for that sort of thing to happen. Like, it's a thing, it was a thing in Asia, it was a thing in Africa. Like, we have a lot of legends of, like, people being, you know, clearly, in our words, homosexual acts being, like, a thing. And it's just not, it's just not thought of that way now, because it's so, the way that we're taught history and the way we're taught gender, especially, which seems to be a product of the Industrial Revolution, whereby you needed to be able to move people around according to like specific functions. So you assign a set of functions to this body you call a woman. You assign a set of functions to this body you call a man, right? And everyone's stuck in that. And you don't cross over, because if you cross over, that just, I don't know, like, I guess it messes up somebody's spreadsheet somewhere.
Add the rise of timepieces into that.
Yes.
Yeah, the increasing availability of clocks and how they could suddenly set schedules where people had to be someplace at a given time. And
Yeah, and with the rise of the rise of the nuclear family, and the idea that the nuclear family is the most natural set of family there is. You don't have multi-generational households anymore. You don't have groups of people living together communally anymore, because that's not really economically viable. You can't move an entire community of people, but you can move just a family. You can keep them busy, like providing for their kids and whatever.
Well, and there's also a lot of ink spilled about the rise of a public education, particularly bringing children together of the same age, which wasn't something that really happened until the 19th century.
Yeah,
they just worked alongside adults.
System. Yeah, And that school education system is designed to create workers, really. Mm-hmm. It's not designed to educate per se. It's you need, you know, if you can't like work the kids so hard all day long, then you put them somewhere where they can be taught to work hard, just like their parents are doing right now. So that's another thing that, you know, kind of like gets lost in the shuffle, especially here in Malaysia, where it's like, well, the British, you know, introduced to us good things like democracy and an education system. And I'm just like, no, they didn't. They actually used that to like control us. You don't understand. Don't talk to me about this.
Introduced is a really kind way to say, more like imposed. Brought it along and said, here you go. You have to use this now. I mean, I'm saying that not knowing anything about Malaysia, but in many countries, that's kind of like, yeah, we brought you democracy, but by brought you, we held you at gunpoint and said you have to have it.
They voluntold you.
Yeah.
Yes, we were voluntold. But it's not a thing that we want to talk about, really. I mean, there's a whole mess of things about Malaysia that I could talk about, but it's not really relevant to steampunk.
I did think it was interesting, and I did want to ask a question about movies in a minute. But you know, talking about what you said, Sherry, that the idea that, you know, people seem shocked when they read about a character in a period of time that doesn't fit their preconceived notions about what the roles were for people. So you know, you get like a kick-ass heroine in, I don't know, late 1800s, you know, running around being a spy, and it's like, oh my god, it's shocking. And the book that immediately came to mind when I was thinking about that was Karen Memory by Elizabeth Baer, which came out earlier this year, in which her main characters are primarily prostitutes who eventually basically go to war with the town's, like, supervillain, essentially. And there's a great scene where the main character basically takes a giant mechanical sewing machine and, like, fights it like a mech. It's really great. It's wonderful. And one of the other characters she has is a real historical figure of U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves, who I don't know how accurate she is in the book to it. I can't recall because I don't know if I'm about Bass Reeves, but Bass Reeves is like known as like he had the he's like historically known for having like 1,000 arrests as a U.S. Marshal. Like this guy was a hardcore marshal. He went and got people. He got his man. And he was a black man.
Yeah, the one the Lone Ranger was loosely based on.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they made him white, too. But,
yep, yeah. They made him white because, of course, you know. And I found that so fascinating because, like, his character was so interesting to read. But, of course, you know, that's not the, like, when are we going to ever get the Bass Reeves story movie, you know, starring Morgan Freeman or whomever. I mean, it could be anybody. Idris Elba.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, gosh, that would be great, right?
I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? You know, he's from Chattanooga. We're all very proud of him. He comes to town once in a while, and the entire city knows about it, and is just so squeeful, it's adorable.
That's great. But anyways, like, I just really thought that, you know, I mean, that book did kind of throw me for a loop, because there's a lot that I wasn't expecting, and then I just found myself really enjoying it. Because I was getting characters which turned out to be real characters, and it was just fun. So, but in any case, so the question I did wanted to jump us to, and it was something we were talking about off podcast, and I had mentioned that, you know, I couldn't recall many steampunk movies, and that we needed more steampunk movies. I mean, I can think of one off the top of my head, but it's not a good movie, and I don't know if it's really steampunk, but it's kind of steampunk-ish, which is League of Gentlemen. Of Extraordinary Gentlemen, whatever.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
It's really just League of Gentlemen, though, because nothing extraordinary about the gentleman in the movie. But I don't really know if that's quite steampunk, and I was curious if any of you knew of any films that dealt with it, or as Sherry may have, did mention in the comments, maybe any games. I think a certain game may show up. So I'll just start with you, Beth, if you have any things you wanted to throw out.
Well, as far as movies, yeah, I remember seeing the movie that you mentioned, and I think Sean Connery being in it was probably the only notable thing.
It was the movie that ended his career, so.
that's sad. But yeah, I think to me, the movies that get steampunk right are anime. There is a tremendous amount of anime that just nails steampunk, especially Miyazaki. Howl's Moving Castle. That is so pure steampunk. It's awesome. And then you mentioned games that use steampunk, and I think Final Fantasy III, as I first knew it, but the true number is Final Fantasy VI. That is like the first place where I saw epic fantasy melded with steampunk, and I was 14 when that came out, and it blew my mind. It was just, that whole game, just, I loved it. And of course, Final Fantasy is known for using lots of steampunk anyway, with airships and all that throughout. But yeah, to me, those are the really good examples.
Perfect. Sherry, you want to jump in, offer a couple of options? You can.
About what? Video games?
Video games or movies, either one works.
Well, the thing about steampunk movies is we need a big tent pole, the asterisk to which are not either one, but you've never heard of it, or B, but it doesn't suck. because we had a lot of steampunk movies there for a little while that kind of sucked. And so when you're trying to tell grandma about it, like, hey, grandma, I'm a goth. And grandma goes, what does that mean? And you go, hey, you know, Dracula, it's kind of like that. Or you go, hey, I'm going to a science fiction convention. Really, what's science fiction? Okay, you know, like Star Wars or Star Trek, it's kind of like that. And steampunk never got that movie. Not yet. Not one that, like, enough people point to that it doesn't even really matter how good it was if enough people appreciated it. And that just hasn't happened.
We do.
What was it? Did I miss something?
I want to argue that we do.
What is it? What would you argue?
Wild Wild West with Will Smith.
Oh, God, no.
I loved it, but everybody thought it sucked.
Wild Wild West.
I love Kevin Kline.
People hate Wild Wild West.
That's what I mean.
That's the thing, though. If you rewatch it, it's not that bad.
Okay, I will tell you like the one anecdote of coolness.
It's not that bad if you rewatch it.
I know, one cool thing.
It's just silly.
Just one cool thing about Wild Wild West that no one can argue about, that it's totally cool. Okay. So I did an event at Old Tucson Studios a couple years ago, and they have there the engine, the Reno, which has been in, it's like the most filmed object in the history of film or whatever. I don't know. But it's an old engine from like the 1860s that ended up being in a bunch of movies because it was junked. So it's on the back lot at the Old Tucson Studios. At some point, there was a big fire on the back lot, and the insurance company totaled it. They said, we're not going to pay to restore it. And they didn't care that it was a big piece of movie history and even social history for the United States. You know, they didn't care. Will Smith heard about it. And they used the Reno in the Wild Wild West movie. So Will Smith had it shipped out to California, fully restored, and donated back to the studio at his own expense.
Wow.
And that is awesome.
That's cool.
That's like a ridiculous thing that I would do if I had nothing but money, and I love him for it.
Way to go, him. Wow.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, did you have anything, any films that are not tentpoles that you think are worth checking out? Or not films, TV shows, or any kind of media product that's not a book?
All right. Actually, I also really enjoyed Wild Wild West, not least of all because I love Will Smith and Kevin Kline. I mean, come on, what's not to love? Obviously, I think the comic books, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, at least up until the Black Dossier. And certainly, I think for TV, one thing that gets overlooked, the late 90s show, Jack of All Trades, with Bruce Campbell, was hilariously and adorably steampunk, and it was darling. Video games, you got to look at BioShock. You have to talk about BioShock. Not even prior to...
Particularly Infinite.
Particularly Infinite, but even prior to that, it was, I mean, you can say decopunk if you want, but people talk about decopunk and bustlepunk and dieselpunk and whatever. I always compare it to romance novels. Like, you still know where there's, you know, historical romance and time traveling romance and paranormal romance, but they're all kind of under one umbrella. And BioShock, for being a little bit later than we traditionally conceive of steampunk, was still very, very historically punked. And then Infinite comes along and kind of blows that out of the water. Oh, God. Fallout is another good one. I'm sorry. There's now officially been too much drum for me to answer this intelligently. But anyway, I like a lot of stuff like that. So there.
No, that's fine. You offered a few examples. I think that's perfectly fine. So we'll jump to you, Jamie. Anything you would like to throw out there?
So many. Do you want Hollywood movies first?
Any movies.
Or do you want the Asian ones?
Just throw a couple of each.
Start with the generic Hollywood ones then. So... I still want to, like, put forward Wild Wild West.
because I think giant spider robot is still one of the best steampunky things I have seen in a movie. I also want to throw out Hugo.
There's
a bunch of other things we could throw out, like Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, the Mummy series, and the Sherlock Holmes of RDJ, right? But I think I really love Hugo, and I think one of the things that I find, it speaks so much to the steampunk sensibility, in the sense that there's this beautiful line in Hugo where particular character is talking to, I don't remember what's her name, but he's talking about why he loves clocks, right? And he's an orphan. His dad died. He doesn't know where his uncle is. And he says to her, I love clocks because when you get a clock, every component in a clock has its place. There are no spare parts. And I wonder if maybe, you know, there's a place for me out there somewhere, because he feels currently like a spare part that's unused and has no home, has no function. And I think that is just such a beautiful line. And it's, the plot is about recuperating old technology too, which is a lot of what we'd like to do in steampunk. So yeah, that's what I really wanted to put out there. Are you guys still with me? You guys still with me?
Yeah,
I'm going to throw you a bunch of names from the Asian market right now. You ready?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So one of my favorite movies, in Asia, it's called The Queens of Langkasuka. Langkasuka is a Patanid kingdom. It used to be, it's now, what, I think it's now Kelantan. It's one of the eastern states on the Malaysian Peninsula. And it was known for, it was a very prosperous kingdom, which was also always in threat of pirates because it's on the coast. And its most prosperous time was when it was ruled over by three queens in a row. That's why it's called the Queens of Langkasuka. If you go onto Netflix, you'll find it under the name of The Legend of the Tsunami Warrior. And again, it's a multicultural cast. You've got Chinese, you've got Thai, you've got Malay, you've got people speaking different languages. You've got people from different classes. You've even got like your token white people in there and attempts to speak English well. It's about like trying to fight against the pirates using really, really old technology. So it's a lot of fun. Also from Thailand is Dynamite Warrior. I'm not sure you can get that on Netflix, but it's called Dynamite Warrior. And this dude is like riding dynamite rockets as like a form of flight, which is pretty cool. And finally, there's The Good, The Bad, and The Weird. That's kind of like a steampunk western, I guess, from Korea, South Korea. And it's kind of like a take on The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. But it's set really firmly in Manchuria and in the 19th century, early 20th century. And of course, like Japanese anime, Steam Boy. I think Princess Mononoke is pretty steampunk as well. There's one, I think it's like, there's an anime, and I'm totally blinking on it. I will get back to you sometime in the near future, I hope. But yeah. And I also agree with Final Fantasy 6, 9, maybe 8. And of course, there's Avatar The Last Airbender, if you want to come back to like United States shores. Like, that's pretty steampunky. Very Asian. Very steampunky. Like, no one really thinks about it as steampunky, but it totally is.
Well, the newer series
like,
is...
Fire Nation and the Industrial Revolution, like the industrialization of the Fire Nation. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. I could certainly see there's some of that there, yeah.
That's one of, and Screw on Head. Have you guys seen Mike Mignola's The Adventures of Screw on Head?
No.
Oh, I am familiar with it, but I haven't actually seen it.
They were going to make a TV series out of it. There's a pilot episode available on the internet. It's really funny. I can't even like get offended at some of its more racist moments because it's so ridiculous and so over the top. It's so meta and aware of the tropes that it's trying to mess around with. So maybe I should totally check that out. It's funny.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, all right. So we've got some people that we need to send off to bed, and yes. Jamie needs to go actually have a day because you're 12 hours ahead. So we've kept you for a bit. So really briefly, I'll go down the line again and just have you guys mention some of your upcoming and or recent work. I mean, Beth, you had a second novel come out this year. Sherry had a book come out earlier this year, and that is, as she mentioned, not steampunk based, but that's okay because it's still cool. And you've got one coming out at the end of August, as I recall. And then, Jamie, you are editing a secret project, which is probably not secret, but I'm going to say it's secret so that I can entice people. So why don't we start with you first, Beth, and tell people a little bit about your new book.
Okay, thank you.
That's cooler.
Well, my Clockwork Dagger series, it's a duology, so it's two central books, and then I have other short stories that build onto the world. And the second book of the two, Clockwork Crown, came out in June, so that wraps up Octavia's story. And then in November, I have a novella that's coming out that's in the Clockwork Dagger world that's already available for pre-order. It's going to be called More Than Silver, if all goes well. And then I'll have another short story next year within the Clockwork Dagger world. And then, like, next summer or fall, I'm going to have my new steampunk series starting. And that first book is Breath of Earth, and that's the one I mentioned earlier. That is 1906 San Francisco with a whole different concept of world war. And, yeah, so there's a whole lot of cool stuff to look forward to.
Awesome, awesome. So folks have a lot they can read this year as they wait the very long time for the publishers to finally put the new thing out.
Yes, the new shiny.
The new shiny. Sherry, what about you?
Well, my big steampunk series, The Clockwork Century, has wrapped up for now. The five primary books are through Tor. It starts with Bone Shaker and ends with Fiddlehead. There are also two little side projects we did through Subterranean, Clementine, and one called Jacaranda, which is kind of an epilogue to the series. You find out what happens to a couple of the characters. And basically, I wanted to write a haunted hotel story about a hotel I know in Florida. So there you go. More recently, last year, I did a project called Maplecroft. It was basically Lizzie Borden fighting Cthulhu with an axe. And I love it. It's one of my favorite things I've ever done. And September 1st, I went and looked up the date while we were talking. The follow-up to that called Chapelwood comes out. And it's I wouldn't say it's steampunk, but it's definitely steampunk adjacent.
That counts.
That counts.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to start adding subcategories of steampunk. Yeah. So steampunk adjacent will be its own thing.
Excellent.
And then we'll put diesel punk and wood chip punk is another one.
Stitch punk.
Stitch punk. Yeah, we got to have stitch punk. That's really important. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hockey punk.
Hockey punk. Yep, there you go.
Why
maybe
not?
Silk punk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, cool. So, Jamie, you have a collection you're editing, and you also have a blog that I don't know if you've named, but you may want to mention that, where you talk about steampunk.
Oh, okay. So the blog, which has yet to be updated in a while because I've been so, like, I've been drowning in grad school, is still The Goggles, and everyone should, like, read that because I'm kind of tired of repeating myself about how racist steampunk is. But the anthology that's coming out, I'm really excited about it. It's called The Sea Is Ours, Tales of Steampunk Southeast Asia. And we're going to have Indiegogo for it sometime in September. I don't have confirmed dates yet. Probably September 22nd. And so I will totally announce it on my blog. I will also announce it on the book's blog, which is c-steampunk.blogspot.com. The book itself will come out 1st of November. There might be a book party. I don't know yet. If there will be a book party, it will probably be in Riverside, California. I'm also going to be part of, so at UC Riverside, we have a science fiction program. It's called Science Fiction and Technoculture Studies. You can minor in it. You can also do a designated emphasis at grad school level. So if you ever wanted to do science fiction at, you know, as a PhD, you should totally come to my university. Anyways, so we got like this buttload of money to host like a series of seminars and events at UCR this coming school year. And so the theme is going to be alternative futurisms. There's going to be a mini conference kicking off this alternative futurisms series. I believe it's October 16th, and again, like I will post it somewhere in about a month or so. And I will be presenting at it. I'm going to be presenting on Indigenous steampunk. So if you wanted to like hear, you know, me talk about and deliver this monologue about Indigenous steampunk and how different it is from, like, I don't know, mainstream steampunk, you should totally come. It's also free, which is awesome, because usually conferences are not free to the general public. So this one's free to the public. If you happen to be in Southern California, happen to have time on a day, you should all come out. And yeah, that's what I've got at steampunky on my side. I mean, I have a cyberpunk short story coming out somewhere later this year.
Thanks, all of you, for agreeing to come together and dealing with a few technical issues. So thanks, Beth, very much for joining me.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me. This was awesome. I think we could probably talk for hours like this sometime.
We could. We've, in fact, already talked over an hour. A little longer than anticipated, but that's okay. Yeah, it was great. What about you, Sheree? What about you? That's a stupid thing for me to say.
What about me?
What about you? Are you glad to be here?
Yeah, glad to be here. This is darling. I'm so glad I was able to wrestle Skype into shape so we could make it work. And I'm sorry for sending you a bunch of panicked emails this afternoon.
Not a worry. And thanks so much, Jamie, for also joining us from the far off land of Malaysia.
No problem. This was fun. Thank you for putting up with all the technical issues coming from a very, very scattered connection.
Not a problem. And thanks, Rachel, for being my co-host.
Always.
All right. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.